So we always do a little after hours at the Radio Book Club. This is only for the podcast, so we can you can curse if you want. I know you've been holding back. Okay. No profanities on the radio version, but now we're podcasting. You can say what you want. And we'll invite audience members, if you have a question or a comment, raise your hand. Elizabeth, were there elements of the story that didn't make it into the final book? Threads and back narratives and various different things.
A lot. There was a lot of background information on Lillian and Murray and their life together as a young married couple. There were a lot of scenes between Gavin and Lizzie. Gavin is the much older boyfriend, and there were a lot of scenes between Gavin and Lizzie that didn't make it into. That always happens. I mean, I probably wrote 4 pages for every page that made it into the manuscript.
And is that your editor or you or a collection, combination of the two?
That was me, because I sent off a much abbreviated version of this. Not much abbreviated compared to this, but I edited out those other scenarios, got rid of them.
Yeah, that's got to be hard as a writer, is it? Or?
It's hard, but it's a discipline that you've got to have. You have to, there's this quote from Hemingway that gets quoted at all these writing conferences. You have to kill all the darlings. Mm-hmm. You have to get rid of those bad lines and those bad scenes.
Well, we're very happy with what ended up in the book.
Yeah, so In the Heart of the Canyon was written a while ago.
Yeah.
And so this was not necessarily your next project, was it?
No, it was not. In the Heart of the Canyon came out in 2011. It's now 2018. I did not take 6 years to work or 7 years to work on this novel. I was working on 2 other novels, and they didn't work out. And that was a real blow emotionally to kind of spend all of this time working on them and then have my agent say, I don't think this works. And it wasn't just my agent's opinion. I took a good, strong look at these 2 novels written in succession and decided, no, it would really be a big mistake for me to try and send these out. One of them had a very unsympathetic narrator. Another had a main character who I didn't respect. It was a novel about a woman who becomes a sugar baby, and I really wanted to write this book about somebody who becomes a sugar baby, a kept woman. And I just could not respect her for what she was doing. The limits of my imagination were really taxed in that book. And I think it showed in the final product. So as much as it hurt, I had to put those aside. And then I started Go Ask Fanny, and it was a leap of faith because, I think after 3 books, if this 3rd book had not worked out, I don't know what I would have done. I would have gone to accounting school or something.
How nervous were you sending this one off to your agent? I mean, did you feel like this is different than those last 2? This is going to work? Or had your confidence been shaken a little bit and were you nervous sending this out?
You just summed it all up. I thought it was better, but I was really nervous. And I think I did a lot of yard work between the date that I sent it to my agent and the date that she got back to me. I was really nervous, but I did have this sense like, not only is this the best that I can do, but it's a good novel. I think it's good, but there's always that nagging doubt. I mean, I think as a writer, you live a life of doubt. And even if you've had numerous successes, I think if you're all too sure of something, that's a bad sign.
But that idea that you did not respect the main protagonist in one of the books that just went by the wayside.
Yeah.
I mean, as an author, I suppose you don't have to like your characters because all books are filled with characters that aren't necessarily likable. But it sounds like you have to at least respect them.
And that was a question that I asked myself. Could I write? I mean, is it really the fact that I didn't respect her? Was that the fatal flaw of that book? I'm not so sure. There might be a way of writing a book where you don't respect the decisions that a character makes. And make it work. But in that book, that was a big factor for me.
Looks like we have some questions from the audience.
I don't know whether you can answer this or not, but how do you decide what you're going to leave out and what you're going to put in?
It takes time. I think that's a good question. She asked, did everybody hear the question? Okay. How do I decide what to leave out? Usually I take a break from a novel. of at least a month or 2 months, and it may coincide with the holidays coming up, just something as simple as that. And I get back to it, and I try and read it really objectively. Sometimes it's a matter of my husband reading it when I think it's done, and I give it to my husband to read, and he says, you know, this is going on for too long. I'm not really interested in all of this. So other readers help you decide what to take out. And my own editor at Putnam's actually had me put scenes in. I had to add scenes for her. She was not having to take things out. So.
All right, we have another question from the audience, I think. Did we? Nope, maybe that was it. Was that a good state to be in, though? I would think it would be, you as a writer, you'd rather add scenes in, perhaps, than take them out, especially if you didn't think they had to come out. Like,
yeah, I've had both. I handed, in The Heart of the Canyon was 700 manuscript pages for a book that really should have been about 450, and I handed that in and had to take out
a lot,
yeah. And this was kind of, I was in a writer's group when I was writing in The Heart of the Canyon, and they were wonderful. It was a group of local writers, and they were really, really great. But the one thing that they did that steered me in the wrong direction was they kept saying, oh, this is a great scene. I want to know more about Evelyn. I want to know more about this character. And so I wrote more, and I produced more, and I put every single detail that you would want to know about a trip down the Grand Canyon into this book. And when I sent it off to my editor, she was like, oh, let's cut a little bit of this.
Your editor lives in New York instead of Colorado, where they're not as interested in the trip down the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
You know, we had Matthew Sullivan on a couple months ago for his book, The Bright Ideas Bookstore, and he talked about how he had to cut 200 or 300 pages out of that book, almost a whole novel worth, because he had a whole other character that he ended up excising completely out of the book towards the end of the process.
Uh-huh.
So it's not uncommon. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the structure of your book, because you're doing back and forth between two specific time periods, if you make an adjustment in one time period, that could impact another time period? I mean, was there a sense of, I need to keep track of who's doing what and when they're doing it so it all makes sense when it is published?
Yeah. And that's where you depend on a copy editor to read the book closely and make sure that what you've changed makes sense. But I use a lot of Post-it notes and different colored Post-it notes, and we'll trace the different themes or the different balls in the air. You know, when you're writing a book, you come up with this idea and you toss a ball in the air, and that becomes an issue that has to be resolved. And then you toss another ball in the air, and suddenly you realize you've got all these balls in the air, and they have to come down at some point. And that's where I use colored Post-it notes and a big blank wall and trace the narrative arc of each of these balls in the air so that I can literally see them come down.
Well, in terms of your writing process, you did say there was at least one similarity with Lillian, the mother in the book, that you put a bungee cord at the bottom of the stairs.
Yes.
When you were writing to stop your kids going up, or at least to indicate, Mom's working right now. But she also had this process where she would scribble down nuggets of an idea that she would have in the cookbook. So mm-hmm. when you're out and about and you get hit by inspiration, do you have a little notebook or send yourself a text?
Wish I could say that I was that organized, and I'm not. I've used a variety of things. I've used a little microphone or a little tape recorder. I've used index cards. I've kept notebooks, and then I lose the notebooks. Mm-hmm. I've scribbled things down. I now use my phone, and I forget where I filed it on my phone, so I'm not very organized. And I could be a much better writer if I had a little bit of a better system.
Do we have another question from the audience here up front?
Is there any particular writer who's had a strong influence upon you?
Yes. one writer who's had a very strong influence on me is Ann Tyler, because I love her characters. Her characters are quirky, they are ordinary, they are not heroic, but they have this quiet ability to cope with day-to-day events that I just so admire. She's one writer that I really admire. There are two other Anns, Ann Patchett and Ann Packer. And Ann Patchett has a book, her most recent book is Commonwealth, which is about siblings. And Ann Packer herself wrote about a book about siblings called The Children's Crusade. And I went back and started rereading portions of The Children's Crusade. Their last name is Blair. And the last name of the children in my book is Blair. And I thought, boy, that must have kind of made a dent in my mind at some point. It was totally, totally unintentional.
So before you wrote full-time, you had a whole other career. You were a lawyer in Washington, like Ruth, and you worked for the Justice Department.
Yeah.
How, you know, in your mind, when you look back at your life, what do you, you know, that's a whole different career path that you could have had or you did have for a while. How did you decide to give that up and become a lawyer, or was it something you were dying to give up when you had it at the time?
I was dying to give it up. I only lasted 2.5 years. I'm not very good with face-to-face conflict. I much prefer my conflict on the written page. But to treat that a little bit more seriously, I was graduating in 1976 with a degree in English, and I hadn't made any plans for graduate school. I did not want to go to graduate school in creative writing. I didn't want to hang out in my university town and wait on table and start writing my great American novel. I wanted to kind of have a career at that point, and law school was something that you could easily do with a degree in English. So I went to law school. Once you get to law school, they kind of funnel you into a traditional kind of career, and I got funneled into wanting to work for the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., and I was litigating cases. I was in the antitrust division, so we were breaking up movie companies in their quest to put HBO out of business, and I had a good experience as law school, as lawyers' experiences go, because I had a lot of responsibility. In this big case that I worked on, there were four attorneys for the government, and there were probably 70 attorneys on the other side. And the people who were at my level were carrying briefcases, and I was the one who was putting on witnesses. So I had a great experience as lawyers go, but I was dreadfully unhappy. I went to the Breadloaf Writers Conference during one summer vacation, and I worked there with John Irving. And I was speaking earlier about the permission that women writers need. And he gave me permission. He really validated my work. I had some stories that I'd written during law school. Hadn't put too much energy into them, but I'd brought them to the conference. And he was so encouraging. And he just gave me that permission to think, I could make something of this. I could... This could be something that I could do. And my now husband got a job teaching out in Seattle, and we were in D.C. together, and I decided I would take what I thought would be a one-year sabbatical to write a novel. And it turned out to be a two-year sabbatical, and then the novel got published, and I just didn't go back. And I'm very glad. I haven't looked back at that career decision at all.
You haven't applied now that Jeff Sessions is heading the Justice Department?
Did you ever think of using your background as an attorney, particularly working in D.C. in the Justice Department, in any of your books, kind of along the lines of doing a John Grisham-style mm-hmm. legal thriller?
Not the legal thriller, but the novel that I worked on when I got out of the Justice, when I left the Justice Department, was a novel about a woman attorney who has a very stressful job. And is raising a child and is trying to balance work and motherhood. And a lot of her anxiety and frustration with her law firm echoed my own anxiety and frustration working for the Justice Department. That was definitely a little bit of autobiography there.
Well, do we want to talk about independent booksellers
today? Sure.
Or we do have some more questions.
Oh, yeah, let's wrap up with a question here.
So I would think when you're writing a book about a family like this, that they almost become real in your mind, that mm-hmm. you think about them while you're cooking or while you're walking or, you know, but so do you dream about them as well?
Do I dream about my characters?
Sometimes I'll dream about a book that I've read.
Uh-huh.
So I was wondering, does that happen to you?
It has happened to me. I've dreamt structures of novels. There was one novel that I was working on that I didn't have a clear idea of what the purpose, what was driving the novel. And I remember dreaming the reason for that novel's structure. I didn't with this novel, but as I wrote the Murray character, he started out as a man running for Congress in a heavily Republican state, the state of New Hampshire, in 1984, and he was running as a Democrat, and he had a secret. And that's the character that I knew. As I was writing the book, or as I was walking, that's so perceptive of you, because walks are times when I think about the book a lot, he started talking in my own father's voice. And he didn't become my father, but I heard the words of this older New England man coming through loud and clear with Murray. So I didn't have dreams about this book, though.
Another question.
Well, I was curious, when you mentioned like working as a lawyer and then switching careers, and you talked about like working in this case with like movies and HBO, like did you ever consider like working in film, or like do you have ambitions with that on top of just being an author?
Only if, you know, a film producer comes calling and says, hey, we need a script for Go Ask Fanny, sure. No, I don't think about it all that much. There's a great book about script writing called Story by Robert McKee. And he talks about narrative arcs and the structure of stories. And it's a Bible for anybody writing any kind of story, whether it's a screenplay or a novel. So that's about the extent of my foray into screenwriting.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth Hyde, for joining us after hours at the Radio Book Club podcast. Catch it on iTunes, subscribe, and you can hear the Radio Book Club on KGNU on the fourth Thursday of every month at 9 a.m. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Stephanie, we're going to bring you up now. We're going to do a short little podcast version, or perhaps it'll end up on KGNU.
Yes, you never know.
We're going to talk a little bit about being Bookseller of the Year. So Stephanie is the marketing manager of the store. She's the one who kind of creates all these amazing events we have here. And she was also instrumental in getting us the award. So
now, anybody in this area is not surprised at all that this bookstore has been chosen, because it's a fabulous bookstore. And what is how many years? 40 years? 45?
45 years.
45 years. That's incredible. But there are other wonderful bookstores around the country. And so I know it was a really big deal to come out number one.
Oh, yeah. We were extremely excited to be nominated and to win. It's a pretty big deal in the book industry.
And
how
are those awards given out? I mean, what are the various different criteria that people take into account when you are selecting the bookstore?
I mean, it begins every year, Publishers Weekly. There are five bookstores that are nominated every year, and then from one of those five, there's one that's chosen to win, and you can only ever win it once. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's the reps who nominate the
stores? Office reps and people in publishing. We do have one of our reps out there. I don't know, maybe he helped nominate us, but
we'll let you take credit.
but we've been nominated three other times. And once you're nominated, then you have to make the case that you're the best store of the five stores.
We have to put together a presentation. A Publishers Weekly sends you an email saying, congratulations, you've been nominated. You're obviously a great store, but you know we need to. There can only be one, essentially. So put together some type of presentation. However you do it is left up to the bookstore, and they really just send you a list of things that you need to include in your presentation. You know, they say talk about how your store does marketing, how you do buying and hand selling and customer service and community interaction and basically everything that makes you a great bookstore, and just tell us about what you do. So you put together your presentation and you send it off, and you never know. I don't think they can tell you who the judges are. I don't even know how many judges there are, but there are people across the industry, you know, people in... It might be people from other bookstores.
I don't know. I pumped somebody for information, and I heard it was about eight judges.
Okay.
And I think they're mostly in publishing. But we had been nominated, like, this is our fourth nomination. And so, you know, it's a lot of work. So when we got the nomination this year, there was, you know, jubilation. Hey, we're recognized one of the top five stores in the country again. What do we have to do to become number one?
And I said,
Stephanie, you have to do something so that we can win, and then we never have to do this again. and so later on, after this podcast, we're going to show what Stephanie and her assistant Julia put together to show why we were able to, you know, why we're the best store in the country, at least at this moment in time. And
in addition to, you know, the presentation and the little movie that you make, do the judges come and do a secret shopper style visit to the bookstore?
Not that I'm aware of. I think it would be difficult because the shops, I mean, the other stores that were nominated, there was Astoria Bookshop in just outside New York City, Source Booksellers in Detroit. Mm-hmm.
Gibson's.
Gibson's, yeah, in Connecticut, New Hampshire.
I just read there.
And University Bookstore in Washington. So, I mean, it's all over the country. And I'm assuming that the people who are doing the judging are also all over the country. So I'm sure if they lived near enough to a store, they'd stop in. But there's no, you know, there's no guarantee that the people who are doing the judging are even necessarily all that aware of what your store is, which is part of the reason why it's so important to put together a good packet. Because if they've never been, you know, they might have heard of your store, but there's no guarantee that they have been even in your state before. So it's you know, one of the looking, we looked back at previous packets that we'd done, which were fine, you know, the first couple, you know, I think the first time we were nominated was 2005, so I think that was just sort of a Word document where we went over all the things we did, and
we put like two pictures in and thought,
yeah,
that was a big deal.
And then
PowerPoint.
I think in 2011, my predecessor Mandy put together a really nice packet, and you know, she worked on it all on her own. It was really nicely laid out, lots of pictures, and we still didn't win. And I remember she does get some credit for this, because I remember at the time after she turned that in, she was like, if we don't get it and we get nominated again, I really think we should do videos. I feel like that a video would really be a good thing to do. So that's been in my mind for several years, and we got nominated, and it's like, we have to do a video this time, because
they're going to show it.
we are going to show the videos after this is done. So.
But one of the things we wanted to do in these videos, and I think Stephanie did so well, is, you know, the bookstore is the Boulder bookstore because it's in Boulder, that we were able to reflect our community, we're able to work with our community. Maeve has a little cameo in the
right.
video, and I think that was what was so exciting, is, you know, we just tried to show who we really are and how we relate to the community, and it was nice that finally resonated. And we got the award.
Yes, and big props to my assistant Julia, wherever she is.
Yeah, I thank you. I completely agree. You know that we're able to. But again, it's because we're in such a dynamic community that we're able to do all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I personally love fiction. And so I've taken a lot of time to really improve and widen that fiction selection and poetry selection over the last 15, 20 years. But I can only do that because we have people who are willing to go there with me, that people are willing to read that fiction, to come to a poetry group, that people are interested in a radio book club, you know, that Maeve and I are doing now. And, you know, Stephanie can put on all sorts of different events because we're actually able to get attendance for all sorts of different events from this community in all different genres, either whether it's fiction or whether it's science or politics. And so it works both ways. You know, if we were trying to do things and we weren't getting a good reaction, then we'd stop doing them and the store wouldn't be nearly as good as it is.
But the reason I asked whether there were secret shopper style visits was that so much about what makes this bookstore special is that when you walk in, there's just a feeling. Maybe it's just me, but I'm sure anybody here would agree. There's a feeling that you get when you walk into this bookstore. The actual physical presence is beautiful, but it's so well created. But there is a sense that I'm looking forward to seeing the video, but how that can be conveyed to people who haven't actually walked in and experienced it.
I was gonna say for me, it's all the recommendations. You know, yes. You've got a whole wall full of recommendations, and they're great. Yeah, all through the bookstore.
Yeah, that is one of the things that we are known in the industry for and that we are very proud of, and we do highlight a lot in the videos. You know, we've got six cases of recommendations, and the first two cases are all staff recommendations, which is something that myself and my assistant, Julia, we work every week on, you know, getting the staff to send us recommendations, and, you know, we hardly even have to work to get a variety of, you know, every now and then someone, you know, wants to get behind, you know, the big new book, but it's like, well, they don't really need the, you know, that this big new book doesn't need your recommendation, but this maybe this backlist title or this debut novel, you know. And it's just great that our booksellers read so widely, and you can really see that when you look at the rec case. You know, my goal for the rec case is that when someone walks into the store and looks at it, they're gonna, you know, they might see some things they know, but most of what they're seeing there is gonna be stuff that they've never heard of before, things that it's like, oh, I know that author, but I had no idea that there's this backlist book or whatever. So we have a really wide readership in our booksellers, and it shows on the shelves, and I'm very proud of it. So
I picked up a book that was recommended by Arson called Father's Day by this man Simon Van Tooy. Wonderful.
Boy.
He was up in the book club. That was one of our featured books, and I loved it too.
Oh.
That's why, actually, the Radio Book Club, I know I'm a co-host, so I'm going to say this, but Arson is the curator of that. He's the one who selects the books, and it's fantastic. So if you subscribe to the podcast, you can get the Simon Van Boy interview there too, and the after hours as well. But I agree, I wouldn't have read that book unless it had been recommended by Arson. Yeah. So what does that mean now that you have this award? Do you get a plaque, or do you, you know?
We get an award of some kind at Book Expo, which is the biggest book industry gathering in North America. That's going to be in New York City at the end of May, and there's going to be the Celebration of Booksellers luncheon. They have. I don't know, I doubt there's time for it. The video is like 40 minutes long.
Well, there's three different videos.
Yeah, we split it up into three different segments. But
that's a lot of work.
It was, yeah.
Well, I'm glad it paid off.
That's why Julia deserves so much prop, because she's the one. She did all the recording and she did all the editing. I mean, she spent like a week like putting this whole thing together. So.
And of course, I tried to be an understanding boss. I'm like, "Where's Julia today?" And Stephanie's like, "She's at home editing the video so we can be the best bookstore of the year." And then the next day would come, "Where's Julia? I need something." So.
It was all worth it. Well, congratulations, well deserved, and we all are completely on board with, of course, it's the best bookstore in the country. So great job, Stephanie and Arson. Yeah. And all the team, all the booksellers here as well. So do subscribe to the podcast After Hours at the Radio Book Club and the Radio Book Club. You can have all of these wonderful recommended reads by Arson. You can hear the author in person as well. So thank you all so much for coming out, and huge thank you to the Boulder Bookstore once again hosting us. Congratulations, and Elizabeth Hyde, thank you again.
Thank you for having me.